listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
The pulse-pounding account of the first time in history that the FBI's Behavioral Science Unit created a psychological profile to catch a serial killer. On June 25, 1973, a 7-year-old girl went missing from the Montana campground where her family was vacationing. Somebody had slit open the back of their tent and snatched her from under their noses. None of them saw or heard anything. Susie Yeager had vanished into thin air, plucked by a shadow. The largest manhunt in Montana's history ensued, led by the FBI. As days stretched into weeks and weeks into months, Special Agent Pete Dunbar attended a workshop at FBI headquarters in Quantico, Virginia, led by two agents who had hatched a radical new idea. What if criminals left a psychological trail that would lead us to them? Patrick Milani, a trained psychologist, and Howard Tetton, a veteran criminologist, had created the Behavioral Science Unit to explore this new voodoo they called criminal profiling. At Dunbar's request, Milani and Tetton built the FBI's first profile of an unknown subject, the unsub who had snatched Susie Yeager and a few months later, a 19-year-old waitress. When a suspect was finally arrested, the profile fit him to a T. The book that we're featuring this evening is Shadow Man, an elusive psycho killer and the birth of FBI profiling, with my special guest, journalist and author, Ron Francell. Welcome back to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Ron Francell.
You bet, Dan. I'm glad to be back. Over the years, I've been with you on a few books, and it's always been a marvelous interview, and it's always found something that I hadn't thought about. So hats off to you.
Thank you so much, Ron. You've been on the program right from the very beginning, right from all of your books we've covered, I believe so. Congratulations on this book.
Thank you. I'm excited about it. I think it's a great story.
Absolutely. Why don't we just start talking about this story and introduce Manhattan, Montana. You say population 900 and 2,000 miles and many, many light years away from the other Manhattan.
Certainly is, yeah.
You talk about in 1964 and 1965, just to begin the story, that someone had been mailing stray cats and puppies alive to power poles and trees.
Here was this little dinky town in the middle of rural Montana, and nothing ever happened there. I mean, that was the view of the people who lived in Manhattan, that this was a small town where the people were good, everybody knew everybody else, and nothing of importance ever happened. As we later figure out, it might have indicated that there was something something scarier afoot.
Let's talk about 1967, March, and Bernie Pullman, a young man, is on top of a bridge doing cannonballs into the Gallatin River below. Tell us about this. It was a
typical steel bridge that you'd see in a lot of places, still do, actually. And then kids did what kids will do. And at the time, Bernie Pullman and his friend had gone out to the bridge, and they'd climb up the girders and jump into the river. And over and over and over again, it's just a typical little boy sing. While they're doing it, Bernie is up on top of the bridge, and his friend notices, Bernie cries out and says, "I've been shot." And he falls off the top of the bridge into the water and drifts away. The friend runs to the nearest farmhouse, which is, I think, more than a mile away. And by the time the sheriff's deputies arrive, nobody can find Bernie's body. It's been swept down the river. I think it was several weeks that searchers went and looked for him. They couldn't. Even kids from the high school turned out in occasionally during that time and helped search. But it was about 3 weeks before they actually found him far down the river. And indeed, he had been shot.
What did the police, they couldn't find who might have done this, but based on their assumptions, what did they deduce had happened that day?
Well, remember, nothing ever happens in Manhattan, right? It had been decades since the last murder had happened there. So it couldn't be a murder. The presumption by the deputies who investigated was that Bernie had just been hit by a stray shot, that somebody out there had been shooting at a rabbit or target practicing, and one of those stray bullets just happened to hit Bernie Pullman as he sat on that bridge. And ultimately, the case was closed with that explanation, that it had just been a stray shot, because nothing ever happens in Manhattan, you know, certainly not murders.
Now, you go to early 1968, May, in Bozeman, which is a nearby town. Sixth grader Michael Rainey and 200 Boy Scouts are at a camporee in Missouri, Headwaters State Park. They're 30 feet away from their adult supervisors. What happens to these two boys?
Well, and not only that, but this park that's actually farther out than Manhattan is in a rural area, on the grass in this park, which is only a couple of acres, there were more than 300 young Boy Scouts in this camporee, and then all of their supervisors and troop leaders and that sort of thing, scoutmasters.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a weekend thing. The kids were gathering for some, you know, to learn some skills that Boy Scouts do, but a great amount of their time was spent, you know, again, being little boys and screwing around and tussling and hiding and all the things. It's one night in there that these two boys, Michael Rainey and his tent mate, go to sleep in a pup tent among all these hundreds of other scouts, literally 5-6 feet from the nearest tents on either side and in front and in back. You have to imagine that they were all crammed into this park area,
right?
And it was just a lot of people. And the next morning, Michael Rainey's tent mate awakes and he's bleeding. At first, he thinks it's a bloody nose or something, but he then sees that it's far worse, and that Michael is barely conscious. So he arouses their camp leader and many people in the camp who find Michael. He has apparently been stabbed. They get the local sheriff. He gets to the hospital, where he lingers a while, a couple days, and ultimately dies. And it's determined that he actually dies from a head injury. It all gets chalked up by these sheriff's investigators to a couple of boys, you know, roughhousing, and that he must have fallen and hit his head, hadn't been reported because they were jacking around and didn't want to get in trouble,
right,
and that he ultimately died from it. So again, an accidental death. For a time, his tent mate is the suspect, but ultimately the sheriff's investigators don't really believe that pursuing him in any way, you know, made sense. So it was all dropped, again, closed as an accident. An accidental death. And the locals in the area were a little uncomfortable with that, only because they felt that the sheriff's department didn't do a great investigation, because it ended unsatisfactorily. They kind of wanted to know who did it, but that was never determined. And It had the effect of the sheriff coming under some fire from locals for not doing a great job. And to a sheriff in Montana who's generally elected, it hampered him politically. He didn't really get over that. He felt that it was unfair, and he, at least to himself, determined to not be in that position again.
Now, you take us, the reader, the listener, to Headwaters State Park in Montana again. And this is June 25th, 1973 now.
Yeah.
Now, this family had come from Farmington and were on a vacation. So this was a summer vacation with five kids. They left Michigan in a van, and they'd come to this place. And Heidi, Susie Yeager's sister, and her shared a tent. Tell us about this vacation and what happens with Heidi and Susie.
Sure. It was one of those idyllic family vacations where, yeah, Mom and Dad and the five kids pile into a couple of vehicles and head west, and they're stopping at all the sites and taking care of, you know, taking in all the roadside attractions along the way. In fact, they're meeting up with grandparents there in Headwaters State Park in Montana, where they're all going to camp. And it's the summer, and there are campers all around. It just happens to be the same park where Michael Rainey had been fatally injured,
yes,
you know, 5 years before. They are in the park. They are camping. Mom and Dad are sleeping in a van. Grandpa and Grandma are sleeping in a trailer. And four of the five kids are in the tent, and they're kind of packed in there, as you can imagine, in their sleeping, yeah, bags, but they're having fun. It's this grand adventure to them. Heidi awakes the next morning and feels a breeze, and they are in a tent, and she thinks, well, that's odd, but maybe somebody got up in the middle of the night to go to the restroom and left the door to the tent unzipped. So she got up to, you know, see where the wind was coming from, and noticed that Susie, her little 7-year-old sister, was gone. At first, she thinks, well, maybe she has, you know, left for some reason, gone to the trailer or to the restroom or something. But then she sees a half moon shaped hole that's been cut in the back of the tent. She sees one of her little sister's stuffed animals outside. And suddenly she's aware that this isn't as innocent as maybe she first thought it was.
Right.
She raises an alarm. Mom and dad come out. They come to the same conclusion. Susie is missing. They see her nowhere around there. They call for her. Some of the people in the campground even help. The sheriff is called, and the first deputy on the scene sees a trail of footprints leading away from the tent across the lawn to a parking area. And these footprints, this path, is in the dew on the grass. But that is the only evidence they have at that time that Susie's been abducted. And the abductor left no other evidence that this deputy could see. And pretty soon the whole sheriff's department is mobilized out there, and they begin their investigation.
You introduced two FBI guys in Bozeman, Special Agents Pete Dunbar and Bill Terry, and also the involvement of Sheriff Anderson, which you say was still spooked by the unsolved murder of Michael Rainey.
Exactly. It haunted him, and he knew that he could come under some of that same political pressure as he'd faced before if he couldn't close this case satisfactorily. So, yeah, he came on the scene, and of course he's a lawman, and he wants to solve the crime, but he also wants to avoid any of the political backlash that could come, as it had before, if he couldn't close this case.
So enter Pete Dunbar from the FBI, and talk about the early involvement and the investigation at that point.
Sure. Well, it's important to note that the FBI was only involved because of what's known in the United States. It's the Little Lindbergh Law. And it's
right.
A law that was enacted after the kidnapping of Charles Lindbergh's child.
Right.
Of course, we know how that turned out, and it was tragic. The reaction in Congress is that local law enforcement and jurisdictions and that sort of thing all played a role in the tragic outcome. So they required that the FBI get involved in many abduction type cases very quickly to avoid some of those tragedies. And that's what happened. It seemed clear at the time that they were dealing with a crime, not just Susie wandering away. So the FBI was called in. Pete Dunbar, who was the lead agent, was actually a Montana guy. He worked with the FBI in other places, including Washington, D.C., but he wanted at some point to come home to Montana because he had ill parents, and he wanted to be placed in a field office out there. But he was from that area. He, in fact, his family, I believe, great-grandfather had homesteaded that area and donated the land that the Headwaters State Park actually sat on. So he had this connection that was actually significant to the place. But he understood the people. He understood the landscape, and it made him invaluable. But here they are. They're launching this investigation literally the day Susie disappears. And pretty soon they've mobilized National Guard, there's a convention of trailer enthusiasts going on in the same county at the time. They get involved, and it becomes the largest manhunt in Montana history. And there are literally hundreds, maybe more than 1,000 people out there combing the area for miles and miles for looking for this little girl, but they find nothing. So the first few days close with nothing more than they had in the beginning, which was a little path of footprints in the dewy grass leading off to a parking area. And that was it. There was nothing else. So when they turn to the public for information, the public has a lot of information, or it thinks it does. They come forward with sightings of hippies, you know, traveling across the county, and
right.
strangers. And because the rural nature, the small town nature, they couldn't believe there could be one of them, of course. So it had to be an outsider. You're also talking about a period of sort of great paranoia. The Manson trials had wrapped up only right. less than 2 years before. Watergate was going on. The whole counterculture was happening, plus the protests against the Vietnam War. The world, in the view of these rural Montanans, these small town farmers and ranchers and shopkeepers, was that the world was falling apart. And that made this all the worse, that somebody would come into their county, snatch a little girl and disappear into the shadows. And so when the FBI opens up the investigation to the public for tips, they're deluged with reports of these hippies that were seen at the gas station or the market.
Right.
There were more reports of Volkswagen vehicles of all sizes and kinds and colors than there were people with names. Literally hundreds of reports, sometimes as little as, I saw a long-haired guy with a little girl who stopped and got gas in Three Forks, Montana.
Yeah.
So there was never enough to be able to identify anybody. State police were stopping people hundreds of miles away in little Volkswagens with little girls, but coming up with nothing. And it soon became a very frustrating pursuit for Dunbar, for Bill Terry, for Sheriff Anderson, for everybody who worked on this.
You say, though, there was a tantalizing clue that came up about a week into the search. A Bozeman cop stumbled across an old mica mine, and there was a shack. What was found in the shack that was, as you write, a tantalizing clue?
Well, there were a variety of items, but among them, I believe, was some drawings.
Yes.
Some ribbons, crayons, things like that. And it sort of screamed to be a place where a child had been kept. And it drew the attention, to say the least, of Dunbar and Terry and the rest. But in time, it was ultimately dismissed as a terrible coincidence, but that there was an innocent explanation for what they found at that mine. And then they're back to square one. They're back to having no good leads, no witnesses, and of course, no suspects. And things begin to get more frustrating by the day because of that. And it weighs heavily on Dunbar.
Tell us about the call to Sheriff Brown about 5 months after from Three Forks. And what does the caller have to say and demand?
The caller calls Deputy Brown's house while Deputy Brown is actually out trying to find the killer. So his wife answers the phone, and on the other end is a man who claims that he was the abductor of Susie Yeager, and he makes some demands about a ransom. I believe it was $50,000. Right. They wanted them to drop off the cash in a bathroom at Denver's train station, and that was it. So it was ultimately judged to maybe be a hoax, but he calls back, and he eventually he's kind of angry that he's been blown off. And now somebody's starting to take it a little more seriously, but they really still have no clues to go on beyond that. No ransom is paid. No, the whole situation just falls apart. So they're again, for a second time, or maybe a third time, back to square one. They don't know almost everything. They do know almost nothing.
Now, just to talk about the FBI 50 years ago, the FBI advises the family to do what and to buy what?
Well, the FBI is the FBI. They were kind of relying on their tried and true techniques. They are still the best investigative body in the world, certainly in the United States. And they proceed as the FBI did at the time and still do, as a matter of fact, in many ways. Today, they have more tools, high-tech tools, everything from computer databases to DNA. Back then, forensics consisted of sort of primitive blood typing and fingerprints. They believed, though, that the way to conduct an investigation was a lot of wandering around, talking to people and deducing certain things. But it was a gut level kind of approach. What they did tell Susie Yeager's family was to buy a simple tape recorder down at the Radio Shack and connect it to the phone and see if this fellow who had called a deputy in Montana might call them in Michigan. It was a long shot, but they thought, let's do it. If nothing happens, no big deal. And so the family did. The family bought a little tape recorder and connected it to the phone and, you know, got captured a lot of calls that were, you know, friends and neighbors. But it was there. They connected it.
You write about September 24th and Marietta, Susie's mother, is out doing some errand to pick up her other son, Joey. And Danny was in charge, 16-year-old Danny was in charge, and a call came in. You write and describe this call. Tell us what is said in this call.
Well, I don't have the exact words right now. Like a lot of the conversations that you'll read in the book, they come from actual transcripts in the FBI's case file, which I had access to, at least to a great deal of it. He picks up the phone and there's a man on the other end, and the man has information that sounds like it's about Susie, and the son tries to keep him on the line, but he can't record it. He's in a different place, and mom comes home sort of as the phone call is ending, and now they believe that they might have talked to Susie's abductor. But again, he had eluded them, and but there was a feeling he might call back. It was just, if it were him and he had called a sheriff's deputy, you know, months before, and now was calling their house, they had a sense that he might call again. And so they waited on pins and needles for a good time, hoping that he would. And eventually that happened.
You also write about February 5th, 1974, and Siobhan McGinnis, 5-year-old. After school, she's at her friend's house. Her mom calls and says supper's on. And so she heads home, bumps into a school friend, but in the end, doesn't make it home at all.
No, and she's a little girl. She's an outgoing little girl. She's full of energy. Everybody knows her in the neighborhood. And this is after school. It's in daylight. It's winter time, but she's kind of wandering around the neighborhood, seeing all of her friends, and finally needs to go home for dinner. And so she heads home. But that's the last time we see her. And this is all in Missoula, Montana, which it's a bigger city than Manhattan or Bozeman, Montana, but still has that small town feel to it. And, you know, they're only slightly less innocent about what could happen there and the people. It was some of those same feelings as in the smaller towns. But
right.
Siobhan goes missing, and it's, I think later, within 24 hours, she's found dead on the highway, hidden in a culvert on the highway out away from Missoula. And she had been stabbed but not killed immediately.
Right.
She'd been stabbed and stuffed in this culvert. She revived and tried to crawl out of the culvert, but there's nothing around there. There would have been no way for her to call or be seen by anybody. So she,
right,
on her way back, crawling to the culvert for shelter, she dies of exposure in the snow. And that's the way they find her.
You say there's no evidence of rape necessarily, but there is evidence of some sort of sexual assault.
There is. And police collect the evidence that's there. They find a strange wound on her. The knife would have had a kind of hilt that they didn't recognize, but they collected the evidence. They took her clothing ultimately and bagged it and preserved it. But suffice it to say, they had their own mystery, similar to Dunbar. They had no tips. They had no physical evidence. They had a dead little girl. Some of her clothing they had in the evidence locker, but again, that meant nothing. It was just her clothing. It might well have been given back to the family. It just wasn't. It was, you know, they bagged it and put it in the evidence locker. And that's, you know, where it sat for decades.
5 days later, you write that February 9th, 1974, now we're back in Manhattan at a basketball game. And so basically almost everyone is there. And you introduce Sandy Smolligan.
Yeah.
Tell us who she is and about this game and who else is in the stands. Tell us about this game.
Well, Sandy is a local girl. She's very popular. She's a waitress at the local cafe. She's outgoing. She's really just out of high school. She had been married, but she was divorcing from that husband. They just started too young and things happened the way they often do with young marrieds that, you know, right out of high school, they were more eager to be married than to stay married, really. This particular night was kind of the end of the basketball season, and they had a good team that year. Manhattan did. They were playing this other team in a nearby little town, and really most of Manhattan probably turned out for the basketball game, including Sandy, including right. her parents. She had a boyfriend at that time. He was there, but he wasn't with her. He was with some other people, some other girls in the stands, and she had some words with him. There's no indication they were angry words, just she had talked to him, let him know she'd seen him. And then the game was over and everybody headed home, including Sandy. She went to her apartment there in Manhattan, which was over an implement store, and she changed her clothes and she walked across the street, you know, literally, you know, 100 paces maybe from her apartment to the American Legion, where people were in the bar having a good time, as they often did on the weekends. And anyway, she went over there, she saw some people, she did some dancing, and then she left. And some friends recall parting with her on the sidewalk there. And that was the last time anybody ever saw her alive.
Let's use this as an opportunity, Ron, to stop for a second for these messages from the Generation Y podcast. For fans of True Crime Podcast, required essential listening is the Generation Y podcast. Hosts Aaron and Justin cover cases from different perspectives, examining theories and delving deep into the forensic evidence to discuss the most perplexing of all cases. In a recent episode, Aaron and Justin feature the case of Charles Cohen, who in 1988 murdered his parents at their home in Hockessin, Delaware. Many speculated that the murders were a crime of passion or committed in a fit of rage. However, when arrested, Cohen made it clear that the murders were premeditated and had a far more sinister motive than ever imagined. I love that the Generation Y podcast features such compelling cases, ones that I wasn't necessarily familiar with before, conveying the story so interestingly, exploring the evidence, the characters involved, and the crimes. Don't miss hearing Aaron and Justin every week. Listen to the Generation Y podcast on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or you can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app. Now, Ron, we were talking about the disappearance of Sandra Smalligan, and obviously an investigation begins. What we hadn't mentioned, that there was many suitors. You mentioned a boyfriend in the bar that night, Bob Harrison. Also in the bar that night was Jack Smalligan, her former husband that she was still friends with, good friends with. But we haven't mentioned that there was a person that was interested in her and had, before Christmas, a date with Sandra. Tell us about this suitor and the date and what Sandra's reaction was to this person.
Well, and Sandy was a popular girl. And once it was known in the small town that she was sort of single again, she had a lot of interested guys floating around. You know, as you named a couple, her husband and he, of course, wasn't floating around anymore, but they were friendly. She had the boyfriend she saw at the basketball game. She had a lot of guys asking her for dates and hoping that they'd be her boyfriend. One of them was a young man named David Meyerhofer. His father owned the implement store where Sandy's apartment was. David was known as a kind of introverted kid who he was one of those guys who was kind of half a bubble off to most of the people there, but he was just quiet and strange, and they described him as odd. He had asked her out before Christmas. They went out. He was smitten. She wasn't. She didn't really have a good time. He would send flowers or chocolates, but she was kind and would thank him. But he would ask her out a few more times, and she would politely refuse. So she was, at the time of that night of the basketball game, for all intents and purposes, single. Her marriage was, her divorce was still in the process, but she had a lot of suitors, obviously. And so when she disappears that night, the FBI's and the sheriff's department's interests fall on a lot of these guys, and they investigate all of them and ultimately dismiss all of them. Harrison, Jack Smolligan, who might have been jealous or angry about her her dating, Meyerhofer, several others. And all of them were dismissed because they all, you know, impressed the investigators as having no idea how Sandy would have disappeared or where she might have gone. In fact, a lot of times they were pointing fingers at each other. But she was gone nonetheless. She and her car were missing.
You write about the search, and it included a ranch called Lockhart Ranch. So there is a cursory search of this building, all the buildings that exist at this ranch.
Yeah.
Tell us about this search and what, if anything, they discovered.
Well, it's an abandoned ranch. The people who owned it once upon a time were elderly and passed. And the ranch just sat there and sort of slowly sunk into the earth. There was nothing there. Some old dilapidated buildings, you know, an outhouse. It was a barn. There was nothing there useful. Some deputies went out there during the search. This ever widening search that was going on, centered in Manhattan, but going out in successive circles. They got out far enough into this. You're talking about a town that's in a remote place. Then this search reaching out into the real wilds, into the real outback of that area, this unsettled outback. They finally come to this ranch among many as they search, look around, they find nothing. These shacks are decaying. One looks like maybe a cowboy has stopped and had his lunch there or something. They really find nothing, you know, in their cursory search that screams foul play. So they go to the barn and it's kind of nailed shut. So they're about to leave when they find a piece of clothing there that's out of place. Mm-hmm. So they decide to take another look at the barn, and long story short, they find Sandy Smolligan's car inside the barn, kind of camouflaged with hay and tarps and 55-gallon drums and that sort of thing. Suddenly now, this is a crime scene. They mobilize the rest of the sheriff's department. Pretty soon, everybody's out there, and they're collecting evidence and searching the car and not getting evidence about the who the perpetrator might have been, but a lot of evidence about Sandy and what she, how this might not be something that she wanted to happen, that there was foul play involved. And because it was now a crime scene, everybody spread out to look. And in time, they find some physical evidence that intrigues them, And as they begin to look closer, they start to find these little tiny shards of bone all around the place, as if they'd been, you know, scattered by the wind thrown out there. So as they concentrate on that, they're collecting more and more and more. They find some bigger remains, some just bone remains. And now they're pretty sure that they know what might have happened to Sandy Spalligan. And they send all this material off both to a Montana pathologist and to the Smithsonian Institute, or the institution, and where they're examined, and it's determined that indeed they are the remains of a female about the age of Sandy Smalligan. But there's one more thing. The remains also include bones or pieces of bones that belong to a much younger girl, between 6 and 8 years old, impossibly Sandy Smalligan's. It had to be a second. Suddenly, Pete Dunbar feared the worst. He might have the related killings of both Sandy Smalligan and Susie Yeager. And that in fact, they might have the same killer.
You talk about the tools that police employed at that time. And one of those tools that they employed regularly and trusted it and of its efficacy was the lie detector. So they had about 7 suspects, you write, and one of them was David Meyerhofer, but they passed easily the lie detector test. In April 1974, though, the new FBI training academy in Quantico and was being set up, and there was 2 teachers, Patrick Mullany and Howard Tetton. Tell us about how Dunbar is introduced to Mullany and Tetton.
Dunbar is in Quantico for some regular training, just this scheduled pro forma training that he had to do. And he happens to attend a workshop. And in this workshop, 2 fellow agents are presenting the idea that that the crime scene evidence could tell more about the psychology and the behavior of the perpetrator than they believed before. It wasn't done under the radar, but it wasn't fully believed that this was true science. J. Edgar Hoover himself thought it was hokum, but he had died just before this. And his replacement, Clarence Kelly, was a little more progressive about law enforcement. And he gave, mild tacit approval to these guys to kind of continue with what they had been pursuing. And they began to put on these workshops. Well, Dunbar attends one. He believes, suddenly, as he listens to them talking about all this all this science and investigation all mixed up, that maybe they can help him. And he follows them after the workshop down to their offices, and he tells them the basic story about the vanishing of both Susie Yeager and Sandy Smalligan. They think that this might be a case for them to get involved with, kind of test the theory. They saw it as neither that complicated. They didn't think it had particularly high stakes. So it was kind of safe to test their theory. And they asked Dunbar to give them the evidence. He shipped it to them. And pretty soon they put together a collection of elements that that they believed pointed the direction at this unknown subject or unsub, and would help, they hoped, Dunbar to narrow the pool of people he was looking for. If they could say, well, this is definitely not a female, well, he cuts the pool in half, correct? I mean, that's
right.
They didn't say that. That wasn't one. But by giving him all of these elements, there were between 15 and 20 elements, he could progressively narrow his pool of suspects, which should focus his investigation a little bit better. Instead of having the whole county to be a suspect, he could narrow that down to a group of people where his investigation could be focused. And they did. They created what was the first ever FBI criminal profile.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Now, putting together this profile, they also, as they do believe in criminal profiling itself, utilize all of the evidence they had. And some of the remarkable evidence they had was the tape recordings. So what did they do with the tape recordings? And talk about this incredible voice lineup.
Well, that came after their basic profile. They had shipped off these tape recordings. They had gotten better and installed better equipment once those phone calls started to happen. Their profile came before that. They had shipped off that voice evidence to a voice analyst, but voice evidence at that time, and to a certain degree to this day, is not considered that conclusive, definitely less than it is today.
Right.
But they had to develop some other things. So they went back to that profile, as I say, about 15 to 20 items. And when you look at it, you can see that some of that was kind of old cops experience and logic. A little bit of it is guesswork. But you got to remember that Howard Teton and Pat Mullaney had no rule book. They had no system. They had no idea. They were experts in psychology and in crime scenes. But they had no model about how those things would work together. So a lot of it was based on what they knew, and some of it was low-hanging fruit. You know, an example. We all know from TV, or at least we think we know, that the typical serial killer tends to be a white male in his 20s.
Sure.
That's because we have 50 years of data. Profilers have gone out and collected a database of thousands of intensive expert interviews with killers. Teton and Mullaney had visited with a few. And they had no database. They just deduced that the killer was a white male in his 20s because these crimes required an astounding degree of stealth and strength. They believed that probably suggested there was military experience, which, of course, was largely male during Vietnam.
Sure.
They believed he had knowledge of his surroundings and local law enforcement, which means he was probably local. And if he's local, there was a 99% chance that he was white because this county was mainly white. Another deduction they had was that he'd thrive in solitary jobs because he didn't want to be around other people. And that's because they knew that deeply disturbed criminals work very hard to protect their secret lives. So they believed their suspect, the perpetrator that they didn't know, their unsub, would be, he'd live in fear that his coworkers and bosses were always watching him and would know his deepest, darkest secrets. So he'd avoid that by working alone. At the time, they believed that psychopaths' problems, their mental state, their emotional state, was based on conflicts or even flawed views about sexuality. But that was right. An educated guess too, that based on interviews that they'd done with a serial killer named Ed Kemper. Mm-hmm. So now that we know who the killer was, we also know that there was only one questionable element out of these 50. They got it right on all but one of the elements. And even that one element is up in the air because we don't have enough information. And we'll talk about why we don't have enough information. But that first profile was astoundingly accurate. And you got to remember that these guys had no plan. They had no system. This was primarily just them thinking it through and trying to piece this puzzle together using their experience.
You have this incredible, you know, very vivid scenes in this book where Susie's mother, Susie Yeager's mother, Marietta, is basically employed to talk to this person that took her daughter. And so the exchange is extraordinary, in which she tries to get this guy to give, she's begging for him to give back her child. Why can't we have our child back? Why can't we have Susie back? And all kinds of rationalization on his part for why he can't do that, the back and forth. But also, the investigators get a break when there is a West Montana rancher, Ralph Green, and he complains about his long-distance bill. So tell us a little bit about this dramatic exchange that was recorded and this lucky break and this rancher with a long-distance bill.
One of the things these original profilers deduced was that the unsub's psychological behavior would compel him to reach out to the family on an anniversary, because this was important and it was personal to him. It was an intimate event in his life. So they believed that he would reach out on an anniversary, and the anniversary coming up was of Susie's disappearance. So as they predicted, the unsub, a man called and talked to Susie's mother. In the process, he gave away a small bit of evidence that proved what only the kidnapper would know. And suddenly they believed they had the right guy on the phone. They just didn't know who it was. And of course, his phone call was to their home in Michigan, in the town, Detroit suburb called Farmington Hills. Some weeks later, a rancher in Montana calls the local phone company to complain that he had been billed for a telephone call that he and his wife hadn't made to a place called Farmington Hills. Immediately, the phone company recognized the number because they'd been put on alert by the FBI, and they called the FBI and said, "This number popped up." And it popped up related to this rancher's phone line. So they went out there, and they, Dunbar investigated. And one of the things they found was that there was this sort of homemade telephone wire that they had strung from the pole to their house. And it kind of hung low in a little wash. And they found some tire tracks going in there underneath the line. The rancher recognized the tire tracks as belonging to a ranch hand that he had employed, because they were the same kind of truck tires that he had on his own truck, and he had made the recommendation.
Right.
So the attention turns to this guy, and indeed they find that his truck has those tires, but he explains, he gives a reason for that. And Dunbar, throughout these investigations, looks at this particular guy two or three times, but two or three times the guy is on the radar and then off the radar because he doesn't fit. Dunbar's gut tells him this isn't the guy, but he goes through and gives another test. In this guy's case, a third truth test, two lie detector tests that had happened. Mm-hmm. Now he's giving him a truth serum test. Suffice it to say, this guy passes all three of them. And so once again, he's off of Dunbar's radar. Dunbar by this time is just totally frustrated. But the profilers believe that he's actually zeroing in on their guy. So that it's believed that the phone call to Susie Yeager's mother was made from that low slung wire. And it would have taken somebody with some knowledge of how to connect to that wire and to make a telephone call. And that told them something. That suddenly they had some information that they could act on.
You talk about that they asked for another search warrant for David's property and garage and vehicles. And remarkably, he now has a lawyer that he just hired so that they could end the frustration that he felt from the police under this 24/7 surveillance that they told him he was under. So this attorney agrees to the conditions of this search. What do they find in this search this time?
In this particular search, they find little bits of tantalizing information, like newspaper clippings about some of the crime, but also some newspaper clippings about gatherings of Girl Scouts and that sort of thing that intrigued them, that align with some things that they know already. And so now they think they've narrowed down their search to pretty much the right guy. And they do put him under 24/7 surveillance at that time, but it's very open, and they want him to know he's under surveillance. There's one point he actually goes over to the deputy and asks for a ride to the next town, since they were both going to be going that way anyway. And he knew the deputy. He was a local guy, right? So there was a lot of circumstantial evidence that they found there that was pretty strong, but no smoking gun. But they kept up their surveillance.
They also have the idea, the profilers, that they should check out this Lockard ranch one more time. Tell us what happens with this search warrant and what do they find?
I think the timeline is a little off because ultimately it comes after his arrest.
Ah, sorry.
And they find more and more ghastly evidence out there after after he's arrested. And so it's the timeline is a little confused here, but within a couple of hours after his arrest, they go back to his little converted garage where he lived and search it more closely than they had before. And there they find human remains, let's say, that he had kept as souvenirs. And suddenly confronted with literally a frozen human hand that proves to be one of his victims, it's clear that he is going to have a tough time not being hanged as a murderer. And his lawyer, who had believed in him all this time, confronts him and literally screams at him about this. Our killer's reaction is, could I avoid the death penalty by confessing to other killings?
Yes.
Suddenly that lawyer is listening and goes to the prosecutor and says, if you will take the death penalty off the table, we'll confess to two more killings. In other words, we will give you four, we will confess to four murders instead of just these two. You just have to take the death penalty off the table. The prosecutor, after talking to the families of Susie Yeager and Sandy Smalligan, agrees. So late on, Meyerhofer's arrested on a Friday. Late on Saturday, they take him in for a lengthy interrogation that's designed to have him confess to these four crimes, which he does. And the upshot of it is he was responsible for the death of Bernie Pullman and of Michael Rainey, both of whom we talked right at the beginning of this interview. And they presumed in these wee hours of this investigation they were going to come back later that day to ask about other killings, about methods he had employed, about why he would have done these things. They're awful, awful things and ghastly things. But they were all tired. They'd all been up. The defense lawyer, the prosecutor, Dunbar, and Meyerhofer himself had been up for 2 days, essentially. And they were all tired. And at around 4 o'clock in the morning, they take him back to his cell. And they themselves go home to catch a few hours of sleep and then come back to continue the interrogation.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for these messages. Now, there's police in other jurisdictions, and plus they're lining up as well in terms of the Marines would like to ask them some questions. So there's, as you say, there's quite a few cases that they would like to ask him questions about.
Well, yes, he had, he was a Marine himself. There were slowly being realized that he might have been involved in other things. And the FBI was doing its investigation. And so there were other jurisdictions interested. But remember, we have the difference of 36 hours here. That's what they had from his arrest to this moment. So things are in the very early stages. It's important to understand, too, that the term serial killer hadn't even been coined at that point. They didn't see him as a serial killer, and there was no real indication, hadn't really been defined about what we now know about these psychos like Ed Kemper or Juan Corona or even later Ted Bundy, John Wayne Gacy, and so forth. They had an idea that these were freakish kinds of people, but that fascination with serial killers actually comes later. So they weren't necessarily putting together in their minds that he had a psychological flaw that made him kill people. They just knew that he had been in other places, and there were indications from their searches that maybe he'd been doing some things that they didn't want to think about in other places. So, yeah, some other law enforcement agencies, the Marines, had sort of started to line up for their chance to talk to him. That's where they were at 4 a.m. on that Saturday morning or Sunday morning.
You talk about this death penalty and that there was the deal that the death penalty would be taken off the table because he would confess to these other two murders, Pohlman and Rainey. But that didn't guarantee that he couldn't be tried and have the death penalty applied in any other case outside of the state. And in fact, not even in other cases that he didn't include in this full confession. Just as a part of the story as well is that Marietta, who had the horror of listening to this killer talk on the phone and these incredible exchanges where she said, "I know who you are," and called him by name, and he denied it. At one point in this incredible book, you have the transcript of him putting on a girl on the phone to talk to Marietta.
Yeah. That's one of the three big phone calls between them. And he calls her and he's, as he tended to do, he's taunting. He wants her to know he's in control. What he doesn't know is that Marietta Yeager is an incredibly strong woman. And she stands in there and talks to him. She's calm. She's not crying. She's not accusatory. Confronted with a strong woman, he starts to break down himself. And in this last phone call, he sort of in a sadistic way claims he has this little girl and her little girl. And puts her on the line. Marietta doesn't think it's her little girl. The FBI suddenly thinks, though, that maybe he has another little girl. And that's when they swoop in for the arrest. They now believe that they don't want to just keep watching him because he might be he actually still active with taking little girls. And that's what causes them to swoop in to make that final arrest. But Marietta is really one of the heroes of this book. Without her conversations with David, they probably would never have caught him.
These profilers learned so much from this case, the first case that they were employed to create this profile, this fledging art-science combination of criminal profiling. They learned so much from this case, and there's so much that we didn't talk about that, again, would inform them of the serial killers and the aberrant behavior that was exhibited shortly after this a golden age, as it's referred, of serial killing and some of the most infamous and notorious serial killers of all time. With this, Marietta did not want, she had been counseled by her pastor, but she was specific when the prosecutor, Olson, asked if she was okay with the death penalty. She was not okay with the death penalty. And the death penalty would have been hanging in Montana. What was the ultimate justice in this case?
Well, I would say that at the time that the prosecutor asked her, Marietta was ambivalent about it. It still hadn't formed in her head. But the more she thought about it, the more she thought about Susie. And she thought about how this outgoing, marvelous little girl would feel about this. at the same time, she's hearing a lot of her own faith bubbling around, and she's coming to a conclusion about the death penalty ultimately that she opposes. And of course, by that time, the ultimate justice that you refer to has already happened. But she comes to the conclusion that the death penalty is not the best thing for religious reasons more than anything. So, but as I say, the justice that you referred to has already happened at that point. It involves death, but it's not carried out by the state.
Yes. You talk about this case being the first case where the FBI was brought in for this criminal profiling, this new art/science. What, as you write, what is the history afterwards? We know so much has happened. We're watching Criminal Minds, and profiling has become such an exciting and captivating subject for so many people, true crime and even in the fictional world. As you write, what was the path forward for Tetton and for Mulaney? And they mentioned an assistant at that time, Robert K. Ressler. As you write, what happened with this fledging criminal profiling and BAU?
Well, of course, now it has succeeded, or at least helped. And now there's more belief, at least in the FBI's superstructure, that maybe there's something there. And maybe they can develop this as a tool, but it's just a tool. And the fact is, even as they were conceiving this first one, the boots on the ground cops were suspicious of it, because this wasn't the way investigations went. They didn't use this voodoo hokum. They used that boots on the ground investigation. So the FBI was at least open now to developing this a little bit more. They believed Tetton and Mulaney were maybe on the right track. So there was more latitude given. They created the behavioral sciences unit, and they did hire some people. But of course, today, there's hardly a primetime TV crime drama or movie mystery or crime thriller book that doesn't feature profiling in some form. It's easy to think that cops have just always been intuitive about bad guys. But in fact, it was Tetton and Mulaney less than 50 years ago that formulated this thing. And so that's what this book is about. The fact, the criminal mind has always fascinated us.
Yes.
You know, when an especially deviant crime happens, our rational brains want to put things back in order, to make sense out of something that is senseless. That's certainly the case in this crime. And it's not surprising that we would think that way. Since the beginning of mankind, we've wanted to understand the threats that are out there, that we want to feel safe. We want to avoid unnecessary death. So, I don't think that sort of primitive fascination has changed. Right now, our media has changed, and we're seeing more of it. We're feeling more of it. We think we're understanding more of it. There's a question about that.
Yeah.
But these profilers play a role in that. We kind of see them as the knights going out and fighting the dragons. And whether that's true or not is irrelevant. It's kind of just the media's portrayal of that. But it all starts here. This is the origin story of profiling, something we're all familiar with right now. This is how it began. Everything we see right now is built on that reality, that real thing that happened.
Yes, and this incredible case that touched it all off. I want to thank you very much, Ron Francell, for coming on and talking about your latest It's Dynamite, Shadow Man, an elusive psycho killer, and the birth of FBI profiling. For those who might want to take a look at, is there an Amazon page or a Facebook or a website they might take a look at?
Certainly. The book is available at bookstores everywhere. You can do that. Amazon, certainly. If they want to see a little bit more, then go to my website, which is www.ronfrancell.com. And there's a lot of stuff there about the book. And it might give you a sense of the story here, which is the collision, ultimately, the collision of some ghastly crimes with this science that is fascinating to us today.
I want to thank you so much, Ron. We just touched on some of the horror that we didn't touch on in this book. Thank you so much for this interview, Shadow Man, an elusive psycho killer and the birth of FBI profiling. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Dan. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Good night.